Tonight's talk is Zen in America, a progress report. These are some of the things I periodically think about, I've been thinking about recently. It's a little bit like stepping outside the teaching the next Dharma topic, learning the next teaching and continuing the practice and stepping outside our world of, our little part of the world of Zen in America and looking back at it. For me it's helpful to kind of stop and check out what we're doing as a whole and how our little Zen center here fits into the whole. I say Zen in America, but I think also Buddhism in America. I think the as I continue to explore Vipassana and Vajrayana traditions and communities in America, I think that these same principles apply there too. So this is somewhat arbitrary, but I just thought, we like lists of three. So I thought three aspects of this progress report of Zen in America. We could call democratization, commodification, and secularization. So I think all of these, I'll just present a little bit about how, what these mean, and I think there's, we can see positive and negative sides to these movements, but it looks like there is this kind of a movement, a natural movement, I think, ever since Buddhism got to America in these directions. So first, democratization, a shift towards the governance of a community where all people participate equally in decision making. It's a kind of definition. And I think that this connects also to feminization. You might say, well, that's kind of a leap. But I really appreciated recently reading this article that ties these together, I think, by Shosan Victoria Austin, San Francisco Zen Center priest I practiced with for some years at Tassajara. This is a relatively newish book called Receiving the Marrow, subtitle Teachings on Dogen by Soto Zen Women Priests in America. I think they're all Americans. And so this is a library copy you can check out after the talk if you'd like. Based on maybe 10 or 15 Shobo Genzo essays by Dogen, with modern commentaries by Soto Zen American women priests. So, Shosan Victoria, Vicky as I knew her. Some of you know Vicky Austin? She's a very long-term yoga teacher, and she chose, I think they all got to choose their fascicle to comment on. She chose Shinjin Gakudo, Body and Mind Study of the Way. Very devoted Iyengar yoga teacher. I think maybe even still goes to India every year to actually meet with Iyengar himself, practice with him. And I remember one time she, at Suzuki Roshi's annual memorial, sometimes, I think it was at the San Francisco Center, people would sometimes speak to Suzuki Roshi, right? And I remember her saying one time very boldly and filled with deep emotion, Suzuki Roshi, thank you for giving me my body. I still remember that. And you know, no further explanation, but I took it as this practice, this Zen practice, enabled her to discover her body completely. Anyway, in this essay, she talks about body and mind being also related to like masculine and feminine. She says, "My early meditation practice tended to express mind over matter, psychologically overriding physical pain. Though my sitting form was physically correct, it was not integrated. And this may have been because all my first teachers were men." In, she goes on to say, "In practice, the mind-body split, so central in the Western unconscious, hides our deep gender bias in body and mind study." That she says permeates our just Western thinking. She also says, "Though women and men are all human with similar capacity for awakening, scientifically speaking, our brains are structured differently." I don't know what the data on this is. But two such differences are relationality, or the importance and centrality of relationships in women's lives has been well documented. And secondly, sensitivity and acceptance of pain and dissonance is different. That women tend to feel their pain more and divulge this more to others than do men. We got to be careful in any of these discussions to not like get into like some fixed views about all men and all women are like these, but as generalizations, maybe. And maybe even more than talking about men and women, we could say like the feminine aspect and the masculine aspect of practice. So because of that, because of the emphasis on relationality and body, she said she feels that women are more like to support this democratization, or more of what she calls horizontal leadership, versus the masculine model mind, based on mind instead of body, is a more hierarchical emphasis. She says, studying with the mind, so this is coming from Dogen's essay on body and mind, study of the way. She says, studying with the mind is the cultivation of awakening. Mind-to-mind transmission can be seen as the vertical dimension of the way, generational hierarchy of teachers and students from Buddha to the present day. And studying with the body means developing the direct experience of awakeness through physical form. Due to the material, easily seen aspect of form, studying with the body lends itself easily to the expression of the horizontal or non-hierarchical aspect of the way. And going on, a man's practice may be more effectively mirrored by the lineage teachings, which were mostly, virtually all, given by men. A woman's practice may be seen as resistant or lacking resolve due to taking care of their body more carefully. A good teacher will respond to the student's own study of the body and can offer guidance on how to settle the body with the body. She gives these kind of like case studies, or maybe made up, but it's kind of hypothetical. Man trying to sit full lotus through a whole sesshin, feels a little pain and works with it a little bit and settles into it, making great effort, sits up all night, and eventually goes beyond effort and is totally settled and feels like at the end of sesshin he made good progress towards his goal, and it was a successful sesshin. And then her sort of case study woman also is trying to sit full lotus through the whole sesshin. She starts menstruating in the middle. All different other pains come up and take over. And she says, how can I work with this body more? Instead of just like, this body is not a body, actually. Maybe more the masculine approach. I probably said in this room, the body is actually just the mind. You know, strictly speaking. But the feminine approach, you know, even though it may be true, it wouldn't go there. Take care of the body. And so she moves a little more. She doesn't stay up all night. But she feels just as equally great at the end of sesshin. I really learned about my body and took care of it well this sesshin. And she says, so these are both two success stories. But from the point of view of the lineage teachings or the old tradition, it may look like she had less resolve. That's why she brought that up. So these are, I really appreciated these stories because I think these are easy blind spots to have as a man. And I think I'm maybe a little less extreme in the masculine side than 5 years ago when starting the practice. But I notice, you know, I can have these biases. And when we read the ancient stories, it fuels them. We just did this Denkoe Sesshin. Keizan, I think more than Dogen even. He's just powerhouse, pushing and criticizing, you know, urging onward, you know, push through it all, break through. So, and maybe these kind of general gender different, almost like different like world views, slightly different ways of viewing reality, which we maybe don't notice because we just have our view. It actually creates a different emphasis towards this democratization. And again, these are just broad generalizations, but I think it's interesting to look at. And sometimes I feel maybe there's some evidence. Just, you know, for example, we're talking some these days at Santa Cruz Zen Center about some of these issues, and I'm just thinking of maybe like I think 4 or 5 people have talked to me about not exactly complete democratization, but a little bit more moving in that direction. And it just so happens that they were all women. And then a few people have, in the last year or so, maybe 3 people have asked about, is there ever going to be an abbot at this place? You know, an abbot is more like this vertical hierarchical structure. I noticed those 3 people happened to all be men. I don't want to make any generalizations, but it's interesting observation, I think, to notice that we, you know, and then you could say in America. So this is the report on America, because in all the Asian countries, Japan, our tradition, but my experiencing all the root countries where Buddhism came from are all, you know, quite hierarchical, structured. So I think it's an American movement, and I think it's partly based on that also in America, it's probably half and half men and women practicing together. In Asia, it's almost all men. So, you know, interesting how it all kind of weaves together like this. And we could say the positive side to this, and I hope we can have time to discuss what you think about these things too, but I think the positive side is pretty easy to see about the democratization and feminization. I think no one could argue that it's great to have equal gender representation practicing. It just balances the whole practice. The democratization thing, I think, also is it empowers more people. People feel more empowered to express themselves, maybe. I think, like in Japanese Zen, it's, you know, you're at least when you're starting out at the kind of like bottom of a sort of extreme hierarchy, you're definitely not encouraged to express yourself. Maybe a hit if you do. So I don't think we can see so much value in that. On the other hand, it's harder to see, I think, the value of the more vertical hierarchical models. I think in our culture especially, I think it's harder to see if there is any. But maybe there's something like I think about my own practice that was pretty vertical model, and my relationship with my teacher particularly pretty vertical. I think I really learned something about a kind of like respectful relationship and kind of surrendering to a higher authority, which could be a dangerous thing, right? I think it's dangerous, that's true. But I think that's part of why that system has continued for so long in Asia. You could say, well, maybe it actually just continued because it's a bunch of men who are like, if you look at the business world, it's very hierarchical when it's, you know, men in the business world. So I think it's interesting to look at, to like kind of try to step outside the biases, at least enough to see them. Maybe we don't eliminate them, maybe that's impossible, but we at least can like acknowledge, oh, this is what's happening. So the if democratization and feminization is an unusual movement in the Buddhist world in America, another one is commodification, which is defined as to make commercial or turn something into a commodity, which is a product that can be bought or sold, or like a marketable item. And again, it's like you know, looking at the Asian world of Buddhism, it's quite different. And I almost don't notice until I'm like over there seeing, I'm like, wow, it's very unusual what we're doing in America, maybe. But it's so completely all-pervasive that I think, again, it's very hard to notice. But I found this article that I think puts some of these things well, called The Commodification of Buddhism in the American Marketplace by David Patt in an older issue of Tricycle magazine. Which in itself, I think he even mentions in the article, Tricycle magazine is kind of an example of commodification of Buddhism with all its advertisements and so on. But he wrote an article because this is not all about bad or good, right? I think none of these things, we don't want to fall into this is a good thing or a bad thing, just being aware. So he says, is modern Buddhism being unrecognizably reconfigured or disfigured by the power of the market, by involving itself in activities that are meant to ensure its propagation? Is Buddhism in the West being co-opted and corrupted by the processes of commodification? He also talks about commodification is almost like a religion in America that we're not so aware of as that way, but it's a strong value. And if consumerism really is the most powerful, most globalized ideology that human beings have yet devised, can Buddhism survive this latest encounter? He says, you know, Buddhism comes to all these new cultures and always has to adapt, but it's never met a culture quite like this. He says that Buddhism is being commodified is plain to the naked eye. In the spiritual goods catalog, Mystic Trader, a $325 gold-leafed Buddha statue is offered with the recommendation, quote, if you ever desire to invest in a Buddha, here's a great opportunity. Macintosh laptops and Patagonia parkas are advertised using the images of red-robed Tibetan monks. Zen fashion offers a new level of inner peace, and tantric sex spices up a boring sex life. Right? These are, you know, this is almost like normal American spirituality, right? It's nothing surprising to us. Then, so we might say, well, yeah, it really is, like, this is really a problem and a bit corruption or something. But he's very good, I think, here about not trying to fall into either side. He says, the Bodhisattva always tries to teach in language that's easy to understand and absorb. Another way of saying, usable and useful. When the real Bodhisattva settles in the beautiful landscapes of California, Colorado, or New York, how is she or he going to communicate with the world except by projecting a voice through the mass media? The real Bodhisattva will naturally co-opt the instruments of market manipulation to propound the pure Buddha Dharma, by skill of means turning the energy of the desire-driven market back on itself, transmitting a message that ultimately will cut desire at its root. So it's like skillful means, right? Using, we have this commodification religion, instead of saying, well, we're going to step outside that and just like do our own thing. It's impossible. It's too big. So let's skillfully use it to help people and spread the Dharma. He's saying, or is it the other way around? Do the compromises themselves, the quest for airtime, for column inches, for book contracts, for a bigger media footprint, a grander name, more students, more centers, more better bigness, subtly subvert the true message of the Buddha? He starts by saying, by talking about the Four Noble Truths and the end of desire. And so how could this even be going in this direction? You never see an ad that says, at this Zen Sashin, you will be yelled at if you move. Or at this Vipassana course, you will experience severe pain. Or at this tantric retreat, you will not know what the heck you're doing. It's not false advertising to point to the higher goal rather than the obstacles on the path, but doesn't one cross the line into hype and pandering when only the positive is emphasized? Advertising your Dharma event is marketing it, commodifying it, selling it. I don't know, he's maybe a little bit extreme, right? It's kind of silly to say, like, in the one paragraph advertisement for Sashin, this will be very painful. You know, you'll find out sooner or later. Is it the case then that Buddhism commodified is Buddhism light, Buddhism with a happy face? It's easier to sell Buddhism translated into terms that suit the Western mind, but isn't the Western mind the mind that has merged inseparably with the consumer ideal? The mind that expects to get what it wants? Now and fast? Of course it is. That's precisely why fast and easy enlightenment is easier to sell than the old-fashioned, hard-won variety. So, that's the gist, basically. And, I think maybe we have the advantage here, we're a smaller center, and we don't do so much like advertising. But I have, one time I picked up a flyer of the upcoming events at one of the larger Zen centers, and I looked at, like, it was a whole like time of different class series, and I was amazed to see, like, it was like five or six different class series, and they were all like kind of like, you know, Zen and yoga, Zen and it was all these activities. But I was like, are there any classes that are actually just kind of teaching kind of sort of classic Buddhism? And there weren't any on the list. Maybe that was just a fluke for that series, but I thought it's so interesting the way things are going. And you know, I think it's this double-sided thing. It was, you want to make it popular and accessible and to as many people as possible. That's the good part, I think. And then does that become then the whole thing? So it's, again, tricky thing, questions to look at. A third issue is secularization, which means, I have to look these words up, to draw away from religious orientation or to make worldly. And we might say the form of, you know, less traditional ritual and traditional Dharma teaching, maybe. Again, similar, maybe related to commodification, to make very accessible. And various groups are doing this in America, going quite far in terms of, you know, it's not even Buddhism. Even some teachers came from a Buddhist practice, but they feel like even that's too limiting, so let's not call it that. We won't call it anything. We'll take out all the kind of like Asian forms and tradition. And again, makes it more accessible. Those groups tend to be, I think, draw more people, just in my observation in general. And the more traditional ones, it's a rarer group that appreciates. So I found this quote from Edward Kanze, one of the great translators of the Prajnaparamita. Yeah, and a professor at Berkeley University in the 60s. He said, somebody once asked him what Buddhism should do to become more acceptable to Americans. And he said, it's not so much a matter of the Dharma adjusting itself to become adaptable to Americans, but of Americans transforming and changing themselves sufficiently to become acceptable to the Lord Buddha. So that's one way of saying it. I think he prefaced it by saying, well, you know, it's true that it's he mentioned these same points of democratization, feminization, and so on, and these are good things. And he was going to leave it at that, he said, and then he got the nerve to say, well, let's mention this side too. So, questions. I see the value. I really appreciate some of the completely secularized teachers and teachings myself. So I don't want to fall into either side, but here I am at a quite a more traditional place here. Related to this secularization, this tricycle article says, what about the adoption of Buddhist techniques in extra-religious contexts to produce results other than liberation from samsara and perfect Buddhahood? It's pretty common, right? What about the marketing of meditation techniques to relax and improve productivity of corporate workers? The Bodhisattva has compassion for all beings. It's true. And skillful means, right? But did the Buddha teach meditation so that designers of cruise missiles and genetically modified corn and marketers of Pokemon could relax and feel good about themselves? Does a meditation club at the Pentagon represent the pacification of the military-industrial complex? Sorry. He gets a little extreme, right? But I think you can see his point. It's interesting. I think that's what happens when you take it out of context. Maybe even we have the context, the Bodhisattva precepts are so integral to traditional Buddhism and maybe even to some of the secularized movements. But if you take meditation as a technique out of the precepts, for example, is it actually Buddhism? Or is it actually what the Buddha taught? Or is it just kind of something related? He says, are there any guiding principles that can help contemporary Buddhists influence the direction of this process? Though the mantra of those engaged in creating modern Buddhism is, quote, preserve the essence, abandon alien cultural artifacts, unquote. That's the mantra. Preserve the essence, abandon alien cultural artifacts, preserve the essence, abandon. The truth is that no one controls the outcome. Because religions, like languages, evolve along with their own unpredictable paths, only time will tell what forms Western Buddhism will take. What is demanded of those who seek to preserve the authentic teachings is continuous mindfulness of the central values of the tradition and a present awareness of the context in which we live and practice. So I think that's a good teaching. Just mindfulness of both, keep coming back to the central values of the tradition. What did the Buddha actually teach? What did Dogen actually teach as a whole? Try not to excerpt too much. I mean, we have to excerpt if we're going to read something or study something or hear something, but keep trying to get the larger context and also the present awareness of the context in which we live and practice. I think he gets into some points about, you know, our socioeconomic system is so different from the Buddha's time. And he talks about, you know, he says, if you... There's one nice little quote. I just thought. Something like, it was something about the example of, you know, if you pass by a homeless person, you know, asking for some change on the side of the road because you're too much in a hurry to not be late to meditation. It's like, is that the whole practice context? That's a good one. So, those are some thoughts about the state of Zen in America. What do you think? How do you think it's going? Yes, Patrick.
This is a huge topic. And
it's huge.
It's not like, I mean, it's a great koan. There's not going to be a place to land.
No.
And say this is, and this is a discussion with every event we have. But, you know, I am aware that, you know, I've only had Catherine here as a teacher for most of my time here. And of course, her central teaching was about the body. I think I've said about Catherine, and I've heard other students too talk about how the practice that we have all learned from Catherine, we're so grateful for, you know, showing us in our lives.
Yes, I've heard that from many people, yeah, about Catherine's teaching. Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I didn't so appreciate the fact feminization of the teaching, or a gender-centric teaching. But, you
know, and maybe not, right?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. I mean, I'll just be very brief on a lot of the points. Of course, in Asia, we see huge factories starting their day with Qigong or Tai Chi, you know, not for the spiritual benefit of their employees, but also to increase productivity. And so so it's not just a Western co-option.
We could say that Tai Chi maybe is a little more exercise oriented than a religious package.
Right.
Yeah.
But I think there's an extreme spiritual core to things like that.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And in our own Tassajara, you know, the whole San Francisco system depends on attracting people to hot tubs.
Yes.
And yes. You know,
hot tubs and good food.
The therapists from Marin who go down to Tassajara every summer, you know, support, you you know, all the monastics at San Francisco. And so it's this great connection. Rev himself says how many people have come to Buddhism through the food at Tassajara. You know, so people go there, you know. I wonder if they'd have many people go there for the summer if they said, you know, we'll be glad to take, you know, your $500 for the weekend, but you're required to do, you know, the 5:30 sitting and the 8:30 at night sitting.
And the hot tubs are only open for half an hour.
it's a funny thing. The Soto Shu, you know, in their newsletter several years ago, and of course this is, you know, kind of published in Japan with American translators and only recently kind of American contributors to their, you know, to this Japanese newsletter. But they did a series of articles on Zen centers in America, and centers that focused on morning meditation and sesshins were small, and centers that had, you know, retreats in the mountains that offered, you know, retreats in the countryside and had Zen and the arts and, you know, a variety of Zen-themed events were bigger.
Yep, I'm sure, yeah.
And my last point is even in Kazans, Kazan seems to point out with some regularity that his teacher, you know, was up in the mountains and just had a few students. And this teacher, you know, had many thousands of students at his monastery. I mean, he didn't offer why in particular, but there did seem to be, you know, a head count. even in medieval Japan, you know, about
Yeah, and I think, you know, Fuyo Dokai is not so popular, right? He's the one who's like, we're just dividing up our rice like this, and if more people come, we're just water it down. Not so many people came.
So, these are great questions.
Yeah.
I don't have to
think. Yeah, and it's interesting with Tassajara example, it's true that I think the nice thing to look there is like, is the intention, is it actually intentional skillful means to draw people to the hot springs so they can discover the wonderful practice, or is it actually just necessity, and then later we say, oh, and isn't it skillful means? Maybe it doesn't matter, because what happens, and then may it be beneficial. So yeah, interesting. Yeah, it's Gene.
I think it's fair to say that most of the people who go to Tassajara also have a home-based practice at their home.
Mm-hmm.
Already in some small sangha somewhere. Where that sangha would go there and choose to spend their vacation money there who have no connection to losing at all.
Yeah, and maybe more and more the case because there's more and more small sanghas to practice at. I think probably when the guest season of Tassajara first started, probably a lot of the first guests didn't have a practice, you know, in the 60s, and just came up to a nature resort, and then maybe by going there, they established a practice. And the current people who go, I think it's true, more and more, they have.
I myself am in that category. Common then that would leak out into what we call American Buddhism. But I think I've read recently online very similar threads taking shape, and I think it's important to point out that American Buddhism may have as many as 800,000 people, but numbers I'm seeing, 60,000 or so are like us, white, typically middle class. actually still of Asian heritage. Later immigrants of the late 1800s and early 1900s, and then another wave after World War II and after Vietnam. The Asian Buddhist population is much greater than the white.
That's a really good point to remember, that when we say American Buddhism or even American Zen, this was sort of the report on the white not born Buddhist community. And I think that it's interesting watching the Asian Buddhist communities in America, like, was it last week when we had the abbot, the Vietnamese abbot here? I think they're, you go to that community and it's much more like the Asian model, but they're also, I think they're being quite influenced by this type of model. You know, they have their website and stuff. I think probably not many Japanese temples even have a website. And trying to offer more events, make it more accessible to the culture. So, yeah.
My last comment, that it's not just America, but it's actually throughout Canada and Mexico and Central America and South America as well. So throughout
the Americas. And Europe.
And I'm understanding, too, that the flow back to the lay Asian culture of now lay Asian culture not wanting to just provide donations, but wanting the Zazen experience themselves, is greatly influenced by Western Zen flowing back.
Yeah, I think it may slowly, slowly going that way. I think that may be still a very small minority thing, but as time goes on, probably more so.
But it's much more global than I think.
Mm-hmm. You could say it is a whole cultural shift, and in many positive directions, and we just have to, stay awake and watch how we shift things altogether.
I was just about to comment about the this very seemingly critical attitude, this sort of dichotomy of, oh, those people working at those big corporations that make weapons or whatever, doing their, meditation. I guess I just feel like that's a false dichotomy. Mm. The Buddha taught to free all beings.
Mm.
And to me, that's a great gift, that if the Buddha's teaching is put into any form that can reach a person to help them become more aware, you have no idea, what that, just that influence can bring about in terms of transforming lives.
Yeah.
And possibly, going into a more traditional Buddhist mode. But I know, it's used in hospitals now, mindfulness-based stress reduction,
mm-hmm.
and a lot of therapists using it. And I just think that the Buddha would, what I understand the Buddha to be, I would think that would be celebrated.
Hmm. Well, if it
not holding on to some duality of, there's us and there's them.
Mm. It did have that sound a little bit.
Yeah.
I think maybe the point was that, especially if the weapons bomb maker starts practicing meditation, they become more aware, and then they say, wait, what am I doing here? I think if we see that, I think he's saying if they never did see that, then it's still maybe their life is more relaxed. But is it, maybe especially from a bodhisattva perspective, is it just about their own relaxation, or is it about, like, actually what are we doing to the world here? There's a whole middle section I didn't read here about, talking about happiness as part of this sort of commodification thing. And is it all about becoming happier? And he kind of critiques that view. He's like, the Buddha never, I don't know, I think you could argue it either way, but he says it's not really about just being happier, it's about being, like, he takes that more ultimate view of you know, completely going beyond samsara. It's not about like what mood you're in or something. So.
Well, and you know, these changes in beings happen over lifetime.
Yes.
To the Buddha's teaching, and also, you know, the weapons manufacturer is empty of. I mean, you know, there's a certain level of. You know, I think of all of these Japanese samurai were practitioners of Zen Buddhism.
That's a good example too. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So.
Sometimes that gets criticized, right? It's like, well, that, is that really? Did they miss the Buddha's message? But it's hard. It's hard to know, right? It's hard. I think, but maybe what you're emphasizing is, if any benefit comes to anyone, that's a good thing, and I'll agree with that. Yeah, and we're like you say, we're evolving over a long, long time, so. Whatever steps we can take are valuable for the whole evolution. Yes, last question.
Thinking about the first point about democratization, sort of horizontal structure or vertical structure, and I like the image of there being a combination of the two, but the horizontal structure creates more equality and allows for creativity and curiosity and change, social change and so on. But the vertical structure can protect the Dharma and the quality of the teaching. So sort of often you think of a floor and a wall.
Mm-hmm.
That, you know, we have the sun like that, but there's a floor and there's a wall.
Mm-hmm.
And the vertical and the horizontal.
They support each other.
They support each other. And it's just a tension, you know, unresolvable. You can never know exactly which it should be more horizontal.
Yeah.
Like I do feel a need to protect the teachings and the quality of the teachings, and an eye-to-eye transmission seems to be, which is a vertical process, seems to be part of that. The thought of letting go of that completely, to me, feels like a high-risk thing to do.
Yeah.
But definitely to be horizontal also feels like it offers a whole lot of opportunity. And I think it's very interesting that there's probably a strong piece to do with women being so much more present.
Yeah. And I think it's true that you can never really have one without the other, vertical or horizontal. They're actually always together. It's just ratios. So, yeah, thank you. So, the progress report is finished. Now we can just get back to work. May any awareness arisen from this discussion percolate into bodies and minds of all beings everywhere, making a wider view of reality for all. Beings are numberless. I vow to save them.